you know,
Doctrine Genesis. We have an account. First of all, we have to realize that all of these stories, myth is a high truth. And there is a truth, and as Fultman says, we demythologize it, and somewhere encoded, as Bill Jenkins would say, there
is the
truth. You see, there's the story, and as we did with the archaeolinguistics, we get then to the core of the root of the matter. Mm-hmm. And so we have this story that is recorded, that has been told by, must remember, first of all, Bedouins, nomadic peoples, that there was a tree. And that this tree contained great knowledge, great wisdom, and great good, and then great evil, mm-hmm. and death and destruction. And then we have the story of the Melchizedek, who was Lucifer, who was put in charge of this experiment. Mm-hmm. And then we have also, here comes the Caduceus here, we have the serpent that enters in, mm-hmm. which we have in our Kundalini, and we have on, it's a symbol of medicine. We have all of these that come together. Now, what does this mean? Are we really talking about a snake and a serpent who talked to a woman mm-hmm. who tempted her and said, come and eat the apple? And she ate the apple, and she gave it to the man. The Lord God came, and he said, what happened? He said, well, the woman gave me the apple. And then he says, now you're going to crawl on your belly, and you're going to suffer, and...
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What really happened?
What really happened is that we're talking about the symbol of the DNA, the tree, was a mix. They were intended. They were like moral imbeciles. They were not ready for this.
Little children.
Little children.
Physical beings.
Yes.
But without any great mental capacity yet, other than
exactly
the normal processes of life that were necessary.
Yes. It was a mix. And in etymology, you don't even get the word snake for serpent. You get enchanter. Prognosticator, you get a copper, like you get. It says copper.
Con man.
No, but it's not. They're not talking about a surface, a snake, and we're talking about Lucifer,
right,
who spoke through the. Mechanical device, mm-hmm. which was the DNA mix that came out of that, and he spoke through that. The etymology, the roots, bring it
all there. And so, actually, what he did do then was talk Eve into.
He said, "Ye shall not surely die." She says, "Well, the Lord says that in the day that we eat thereof, that we will be." As gods. Now, I get a lot of fundamentalists on this because you say heirs of the gods. It's only one God. It says you will be as gods to know good and evil.
That's, you picked that up from Paul, by the way.
Right.
Paul said we are all heirs of the gods.
Heirs of the gods.
And he used the term and gods.
Heir. Yes.
But what happened here was, as I recall, in Heirs of the Gods, that,
You recall Eve, very well.
That Eve was allowed to eat this DNA mix,
yes,
which allowed for the development of the cerebral cortex.
Exactly.
Which gave her then, and Adam, the power to reason and the power to think quite like the celestials themselves.
Without
all of the fundamentals to go along with it. And what we had here were smart animals. They were able to use the mentality of the human being, coupled with all of the primitive instincts of the very indigenous and primitive life form, which was very much a part of their makeup.
This is why today our technology exceeds our feelings of nurturing and loving, unless we can relate to the spirit and the biocosmic energy at a higher plane, because we also are heirs of the gods. We also are gods.
Mm-hmm.
We're angels.
That's right. That's where our beginnings come from.
Yes.
Our technology has far outdistanced our spirituality. And because of that, we're about to use our technology on ourselves.
Exactly.
And yes. We're in the midst of a technological explosion, which is quite frightening.
Yes. I think it's all predicted.
I was just going to say, I think it's very interesting that you mentioned the whole question about dying and about mortality, because I think one of the great differences between gods and people is that gods did not have any problem with leaving their bodies, but people do.
Yes.
And it's also interesting that you talked about copper, because there is another understanding connected with the tree of life, which says that once the period of the copper age comes, that is the time when people cease to be gods and start to be mortals, and that is the time when the great thought that we can call philosophy and religion begins. And so that, I mean, all these different traditions are validating and verifying each other, and we are at a point when we're going to be able to reacquire that ability not to be afraid of death, so that we are going to be unafraid of the threats to our existence, and we'll then be able to transcend the kinds of limitations that have created blindness, so that people can't really connect between what they have been used to thinking and the new material that's coming in. So I think it's a very exciting moment.
It is. Yes, indeed it is.
We're at a fun time, and I guess we're all here for a reason. I have a reason for being here, and I want to attend to that, and we'll be right. How's our signal coming in up there, Craig?
Pretty good for the most part, although as you'll...
We should put optophonics on it, then you can hear it bright and clear.
I did miss one important part, which I'll get into shortly. Before I even get to the questions for your guests, I don't want to take very much time at all on this, but I did come across a report in the July 11th issue of Science Magazine. There was a very brief article saying that the National Bureau of Standards had issued a report on the testing it had done on Joe Newman's energy machine.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the report that they issued?
I'm very familiar with the report. And
Are you going to do that in a future program?
Yeah, we'll have Joe Newman on again, and I really wouldn't call that too much of a testing job they did. That whole scenario that involved Joe Newman up there is somewhat of a joke.
Okay, well, as long as you're going to get into it at some point.
Yes.
Good enough. I don't want to distract from the program tonight. First of all, since you're not going to be talking about the meditation for peace until later, just one brief question. Did you say that there was a date in October that you're aiming for?
The end date is October 16th, and the minutes can be donated between September 16th and October 16th. And
so there's a whole month in there.
A whole month, yes.
Oh, I see, a whole month. I thought you had selected a specific date, and I was curious. I just considering the fact that August 6th, which will be shortly, is already recognized by many people around the world as Peace Day.
I think it's October, isn't it? August 3rd.
Well, August 6th is the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima.
Right.
So.
There's quite a few particular days. September 16th we had selected because it's the time when the General Assembly of the United Nations begins its meeting for the fall. And so that's also being called a Peace Day. But all these minutes can be donated, you know, pledged from any time.
Okay. Well, let me get to...
Well, Craig, you know the power of thought. I know that.
Well, yes. No question about it.
You know, that's in the virtual state that it goes to work. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to get to some questions for Vivian. It's been a while since you've been on.
Yes, it has. Too long.
And I'm curious, in the interim... Well, let me figure out how to put this. I guess it would be a little naive to expect anyone from the... establishment academic community to embrace your conclusions or to have done so in that period. So I won't even ask that, although if there is anybody that has done so.
Oh, yes, we've had many people from the academic world. I would say not as many early on, but in the last few years, it's almost taken a quantum leap because of the information. It's an awesome age in which we live, you know. And they are quietly embracing many of the ideas that we've put forth, our paradigm. So it's not as sketchy, Craig, as it was some years ago.
And as you know, Craig, I'm as establishment as you can get. And I endorse it.
Well,
we're establishment ourselves. Just happen to be futurologists because that's how the energy came into our being.
Well, to be more specific, I still would tend to assume that you're not finding many people who are willing to embrace the more sweeping or...
Oh, generally, yes. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But I was going to start by asking, are there people who have validated the discipline which you refer to as archaeolinguistics in itself, without reference to the information which you derive from it?
Yes. We've kept that, except for the private meetings that we've had with some of the people in the field of linguistics, we've kept it pretty quiet until we do the second book. That's a choice that we've had to make because we've got some vital information that that we will be putting forth in. Actually, we have a scholastic paper that we did, and we've been in touch with, as I say, some of the leading linguistic pedagogy of our day, but we're I'm hesitating because the thing is that we really have kept it under wraps. Bill knows that.
They have a new book coming out, and
yes,
they're not going to tell us about it. I have been bugging them for 2 years about what's in the new book. And I told them they can trust me. I won't do anything but tell other than a million people.
Oh, please, thank you. When we come back with it, yes. We're very much engaged in another book.
Well, without specifically discussing a book that's in progress, you did have a body of work.
Oh, yes.
Which you presented in your original book. And,
yes.
It was based on...
Have you read our book?
No, I haven't. I've heard many of the several hours of discussion.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I've probably heard every program that you've been on with Bill.
I'd love for you to read it.
I hope to get around to it.
Yes.
So I won't give you any...
I'm not going to give you mine because I've got it locked in.
Yes.
But what I'm asking is... You refer to the academic discipline or tool that you use as archaeolinguistics, and I'm wondering if the methodology itself has been validated by other competent people in the field of linguistics.
Yes, it has. However, we've not had any national involvement again because... You see, we can't let it sit on the shelf and gather cobwebs, but neither can we, it's like when you apply for a grant and you send your information in, you have to be a bit careful about that because you have the people reading it and you have to put an awful lot down in order to get this grant. You have to put down what the work is, and if it's truly new and innovative, the problem is if it's not traditional, you have a problem. And if it is traditional, then it's a bit better. But our work is so phenomenal and so and yet so obvious and obviously simplistic, beautifully simplistic, that if we let it out too much. We would be in danger. We'd be in harm's way. So we are keeping it under wraps. And we're really not concerned about the academic community at large, whether they are that aware of it en masse, because the moment the other book comes out...
Then they can look at it all at once.
Oh, we'll be delighted. Yes, you see, we're not concerned at all.
It's like applying for a patent of, say, something in the electronic age, and you put a very innovative and far-reaching patent into the patent office. You get your patent, and the first person who reads it is Sony.
Yes.
And the next thing you know, they're manufacturing it.
And we don't really need them, excuse me, to validate the work itself. You see, rarely a work comes along that doesn't really need any validation from the academic community, because who, it's like Bertrand Russell said to the chancellor of UCLA, this may sound rather smug, but he said, tell me, why is it that you never got your doctorate? And Bertrand Russell said, well, my dear fellow, I don't think this is an apocryphal story, my dear fellow, who would teach me? So, you see...
I understand your point. I'm not even asking... I would never necessarily expect the academic community at large to...
So what... Be specific. What is your point?
Let me put it a different way.
Do.
Sort of a twofold question. What about people that you talk to and, say, informally submitted it to just for their comments? And also...
Oh, every one of them have come through. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every one of them.
Okay,
yes.
And are there other people in the field who are using the same methodology for their own research?
No.
Really?
Not because we have the innovation. It's ours, and no one has because it's like saying to Einstein, you know, this is new. This is very, very new, and we're going to do something exceptional with it in the new work.
They're on the leading edge there.
I understand that it takes a while, of course, for people to learn to use new techniques, but you've been developing this for, at least half a dozen or 10 years now, right?
It's already developed, yes. And we have...
And these days, new ideas do tend to get around.
This one hasn't yet.
I think the idea is that they have not let out the methodology yet,
Not the methodology yet.
Because they have an eminent book here, and after that's done... Everybody will know how to do it.
They certainly will. Be delighted.
And the whole world will be better for it.
Okay. Let me ask you one other question that's not even related to that.
Surely.
Didn't expect it for that to be so long and drawn out.
That's all right.
This is when my radio reception went out. There was some reference to an atomic explosion or exchange of some sort that allegedly...
On the Sinai Peninsula. Yes.
And I believe I heard you say there was some sort of physical evidence.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Could you elaborate on it?
Well, I will. This is the work of Zachariah Sitchin. You can find it in his book, The Wars of Gods and Men, actually, which is an excellent book for you to read. And it not only details the seven mushroom clouds that appeared in that area, but it also details the radioactive cloud that drifted to the east as it naturally would be and settled up against the Zagros Mountains.
And the pectotites.
And...
pectotites. That's the residue that... Yeah. They found. I think it's T E. They did an article on us, and they had it in the article that we had. Do you know T E?
I know what you're talking about.
T-E-C-T-E-T-I-E-S, I believe. And a Russian scholar has done some work on this. And let's see, there was quite a large article on Heirs of the Gods. Dr. Lee Gladden and myself, and they mentioned.
We mentioned that part, didn't
they? They mentioned it, yes.
The rocks in that area, the mountains
in
that area.
And they found the same kind of residue in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
There is a black coating on all of those rocks.
Yes.
That extends all the way over to the Zagros Mountains. And
yes.
The area was extremely fertile and lush, according to the ancient historians who were there. And, of course, it has been desolate since that time, which dates back to 2024 B.C.
And then again, of course, I have to reiterate that Heirs of the Gods is a space-age interpretation of the Bible. And if you will read the Bible and that account in Sodom and Gomorrah, it is perfectly, perfectly clear that an atomic explosion happened there. I mean, it's... And then in Peter, it says that it talks about the earth burning with fervent heat, and even the sockets of the eyes melting out of the eyes.
Yeah,
the skin falling off, I mean...
That is definitely quite suggestive. But the question, going back to the question of currently existing, tangible physical evidence, do you happen to know who and when these measurements were done to confirm lingering radioactivity?
You can read Zechariah Sitchin... covers that in great detail in his book, The Wars of Gods and Men.
And if you would read Heirs of the Gods, we deal with the explosion in Sodom and Gomorrah, and I believe you could get in the Bodhi tree if you're in the Los Angeles area.
And that was a part of that same nuclear
battle. Mm-hmm. We go into that in detail in Heirs of the Gods.
Interestingly, according to the ancient Sumerians, the target for that nuclear attack was a spaceport, which was located in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. I'm going to have to stop right here, Craig. You want to hang on?
Sure.
Or otherwise...
If you could give me a very brief answer. Did the scientists who did the measurements of the radioactivity in the Sinai, did they themselves believe that it resulted from atomic explosions, or did they attribute it to something else?
The only thing that I have seen from them is that it is the same kind of footprint 4,000 years later that an atomic explosion would have left.
And did they suggest any other possible...
They suggested nothing. It was a puzzlement, as the king
of Siam never suggest anything. They stand on the fence a lot of the times, and
No scientist that has a grant behind him from a major university is going to say that this was a nuclear explosion.
Did you say it was a team of Russian scientists, or
they're not going to do it either.
Well, as you know, there are some Russian scientists who believe that the Tunguska event was an extraterrestrial craft explosion.
Well, I think that's general literature in the Soviet Union.
They wouldn't necessarily be reluctant to support such a conclusion. Let me ask you one other thing, and I'll wrap up the whole call here. Have any of you looked into...
You know what, Craig? Here comes the network news.
I'm going to ask you the question, and you answer it after.
All right, quickly the question.
There's the allusions to this kind of thing in the old Vedic texts. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to.
All right, the old text of the Bible.
The Vedic.
All right, we'll touch that right after the news, Craig.
Yes.
Thank you very much for
Thank
jumping
you for
in
your
with
call.
Us. The Million Minutes for Peace. It's an international appeal. It is done through the auspices of the United Nations. Let me just give you some of the people who are involved in this. Deborah Kerr. Mm. Ben Kingsley, who did that magnificent portrayal of Gandhi. Dr. Lawrence Klein, who's a Nobel laureate. Chris Christopherson, who has written some of the finest music I have ever heard in my life and is a pretty fair actor himself. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, we know her work is legendary already. And we can just go on and on and on. Dr. Richard Lakey, Marcel Marceau, Sean McBride, Paul McCartney. All night long, I could be reading you the list of people who say this is a very good idea and are supporting it. Tell us more about the idea. If you would, Joan.
Well, the idea started in Australia, and it has gone around the globe. There are now approximately 48 countries that are participating in this. All 170 countries have been asked, and 48 are, as far as we know, participating in this. And it is what is happening is that the international headquarters are in England. And there's also a headquarters in New York, and there's a southwestern headquarters that's in Los Angeles. And around the globe, we're asking people to give from 1 to 30 minutes in thoughts of peace, prayer, or meditation. And that would be between September 16th and October 16th. September 16th being the day that the United Nations opens. It is for the United Nations International Year of Peace.
Well, we touched on it earlier, Joan. Just to the casual listener, you sitting down and meditating for 30 minutes for world peace or thinking about it doesn't seem like a very potent weapon at all, to get anything done. You know, you could sit down and meditate about many things if it had that kind of potency behind it. How do you think that this will help?
I think it will help immensely. On a personal level, on a global level especially, the power of thought far exceeds any other kind of power that there is. It's the only thing that it's a thought away. For example, thought doesn't take any time to travel. At all.
No, it moves at infinite speed.
That's right, and there's nothing faster.
And by the way, thought is a thing. It is not something that is in the ether, necessarily.
No.
It's been proven by the Jung experiments and others that thought is in the virtual state, and it exists. And it does work. By work, I mean it goes to work. around you. When you think, you create energy.
That's right.
And, of course, one of the secrets of life is to be very concerned about the quality of the energy that you are creating. Because if it's in harmony with the cosmos, mm-hmm. or harmony with the Creator, then it is amplified. And if it is in discord with it, it then is in discord. And there is a little conflict going around. You have a little electric storm around you. And in fact, out of that understanding of the power of thought comes a definition of love. Love is a thought that creates energy, which is in total harmony with the nature, character, and personality of the Creator. And I would bet you that's the first definition of love you've ever heard that didn't just
like
tell
that.
You what a loving idea was.
One of the biggest problems as far as thought is that there are very, very few people who can sit down and spend even a minute with themselves. And losing that power of thought, you lose yourself. And you lose any sense of peace at all. I know because I've worked in addiction quite a bit. And one of the things that is happening, one of the biggest anti-thought things that is going on is addiction in every way. And this, the million minutes of peace is about trying to pull exactly what you're saying, the harmony. What will you do with peace after you get it if you don't know what it's like to be peaceful?
Evolve into a celestial being. Is that okay for an answer?
That's fine with me.
So, I certainly want to entertain questions about the processes involved in this, the reality of the power that it will actually have, and what is impressive to me, the support you're getting from the United Nations itself. Would you believe, and hallelujah and hooray, that there are some politicians on that level at the United Nations, for which I don't have a great deal of good things to say about? I don't know whether I want to go as far as my friend Bruce Hutchinson and kick him out of New York. However, I understand where he's coming from, and he probably has a good idea, but we can change that, too, with the power of thought, that they could get back to doing whatever they should do. But they are trying, and they are realizing that. I am so delighted that you and Sister Denise is here. Would you have anything? Tell us a little bit about your group.
Well, the Brahma Kumaris is one of four groups in the United States that is sponsoring the appeal. And this particular group I have been with for 13 years. So I've seen a great deal of evolution going on within the group. The thing that attracted me to it most powerfully was that when I started learning how to think straight, clear, deep thoughts, and harmonious thoughts, then my actual quality of intelligence altered, and that interested me enormously, because I have always had this tremendous desire not to be boring. And
I gave up on that a long time ago.
Well, I haven't given up on that. But what I found...
Never be bored.
Well, it's a preoccupation. What I found is that anything which is a bad thought actually destroys our ability to think, whereas anything which is a good thought actually enhances our ability to see with the mind's eye most clearly and most deeply. Now, for example, a bad thought can be that kind of electrical storm that results through fear.
Agreed.
Well, fear is an interesting one because a lot of people are motivated by fear. Anyone who is able to be afraid is also able to be manipulated. And so, therefore, is not free. Anybody who is able to think for themselves and who trains themselves to think clearly and who develops the power to discriminate and distinguish a thought that is worth thinking is in a very, very good position. Now, one of the things about thought is that it has a tendency to become reality. So if you are afraid of something, then the chances are that that thing will happen to you. And of course, fears are going in every which way, which creates a chaos in a person's life. Now, if you practice to think really pure thoughts. Think about things which are the eternal truths, the perennial truths, and about higher realities, then what you're going to be able to do through sustained thought is make that a reality. So that this particular group, the Brahma Kumaris World Spiritual University, examines truths and selects those truths that are the most worthwhile truths to think about. And so that the creation of a world in which people understand each other, get along with each other, recognize each other, dispense with all the games and performances that we do to lay red herrings in front of one another, that kind of a world is able to be put forth through thought. And so what Viviane was talking about earlier relates exactly to this. Because if we are going to get something from a higher realm, a higher region, that has to be also higher quality thought, and bring that into